Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to one of those stories of the perfect job for the perfect person. The Northern Territory is about to welcome a new bishop of the Anglican Church. By all accounts, this is the dream gig for Dr. Greg Anderson. Greg's love for Indigenous Australia goes back to his university days. He's previously served as a lecturer and dean of students at the Nungalinya College in Darwin, equipping the next generation of Indigenous leaders for ministry. Since 2007, Greg has served as the head of the Department of Mission at Moore Theological College in Sydney. Dr. Greg Anderson, welcome to Open House and congratulations on your election.
Thanks for the congratulations. Yeah, we're excited. Yeah, it's a big job, a big challenge, but we're looking forward to it.
Tell us about how you first became so vitally interested in Indigenous Australia.
Well, we have to go back about 25 or 30 years ago, and there I was, a music student at university, casting around for something to do for a fourth-year project. And really, more or less randomly, a friend of the music department had made some recordings of traditional Central Arnhem Land music, and they thought that getting a student to analyse the recordings from the musical point of view would be a good thing to do, a good contained project, so I did that. And loved the music, and the next step was that I got a scholarship to continue that study at post-grad level, so I went to live with the performers of these songs, this song tradition, in Central Arnhem Land in the mid-80s, and I just deeply bonded with these people. They were a long way from infrastructure, so I lived in a tent. We didn't have electricity or sewage. We had a little bit of running water until the solar pump that powered that system failed, so we had to go down to the Billabong and get water every day. And so this was a life-changing experience. I loved the music. I still love the music. Loved the people even more. And in some small way, I've kept in touch with some of those people. And the intriguing thing for me was that this family that I was living with, way out in what to me seemed the middle of nowhere, although for them it wasn't the middle of nowhere, it was the centre of everywhere.
Yeah.
But they were all Christian people who'd been brought to Christian faith through the Elko Island Revival, which started in 1979 in Northeast Arnhem Land. And so every night they would gather around a fire and sing Christian songs, some of which they'd written themselves. They'd try to read the Bible, although they didn't have the Bible in their own language. They'd share testimonies, they'd pray. And coming from a strong Christian upbringing myself, and being a Christian myself, the idea that these people would gather every single night was just intriguing to me. So their Christian identity was really well developed. And so that got me very interested in the Indigenous Church.
The title of one of your publications is Aboriginal Ceremonies in the Bible. Mm. What's the transaction between Indigenous ceremonies and dance and the Bible and Christian faith as you've witnessed it?
Yeah, very good question. So that little book that I wrote was really to, I hoped, still hope, stimulate the thinking of Aboriginal Christians about the place of ceremony. And so by looking at what happens in the Bible with regard to ceremony, there's a number of things that we can see. That there are ceremonies that God gave to his Old Testament people, the nation of Israel, and that God instructed them to keep every year. And there were also ceremonies that the Jewish people came up with themselves. So the book of Esther in the Old Testament talks about the development of the Feast of Purim. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that wasn't a feast that God gave them, you know, at the time of the Exodus. The Jews, the Israelites gathered at Mount Sinai, for example. We read in the New Testament about Jesus taking part in a festival, the festival of dedication, or Hanukkah, as Jewish people today call it. Again, that wasn't a feast that God mandated at the time of the Exodus or at Mount Sinai, but it was a feast that the Jewish people developed themselves. And so it seemed to me that as we look at the Bible, there's there's the law that God gave, and then there's also freedom for God's people to develop ceremonies that speak about God's work among them. And if the people of God had that freedom, then the question is whether the people of God today have freedom to use ceremonies or to develop ceremonies that will enable them to speak about what God's done through Jesus in the world in ways that perhaps culturally reflect the life of the people who do those ceremonies. So here's an example. The Walbiri people in the central part of the Northern Territory, as the Bible was translated for them and as they were strongly aware of their own traditions, they were able to adapt those traditions to come up with some pulapa, some ceremonies that spoke of the Easter story and spoke of the Last Supper.
Great.
Another example from the area southwest of Darwin, Port Keats, they theologized about what baptism meant. They drew on the Bible and their own Catholic tradition to think about what baptism meant. And as they looked at some of their traditional ceremonies, they could see some overlap between the meaning of baptism and the meaning that they ascribed to their initiation ceremonies. And so a ceremony or a kind of baptismal ceremony was developed there that drew on traditional initiation motifs. And I think Christians have freedom to explore within their own culture ways of expressing the truths of Christian theology and of the Bible.
What are some of the challenges that perhaps we don't really fully understand about the nature of expressing Christian faith in such a diverse population?
Sure. It's the same questions that we have in expressing Christian theology in our own language, whatever that is, because the scriptures come to us in Hebrew and a little bit in Aramaic and Greek, not in English, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And so as we appropriate God's truth in the scriptures, we need to think about ways that we express those words. So the situation for Indigenous Australians is the same as for non-Indigenous Australians, whether they're English-speaking or Mandarin-speaking or whatever they speak. Finding words to express God's truth so that it's conveyed accurately, but in ways that people can understand, that's a key role for all Christians. So just to branch out from thinking about the Northern Territory for a moment, here I am teaching at Moore College, and in one of the courses that I teach, we play a game called Banned Word of the Week, where we take a word that is tried and true in Christian circles, a word like Lord or salvation or blessing or grace, words that Christians are very used to, but which perhaps don't communicate particularly well in our own secular environment. They have to pay a little fine if they use the banned word. But the point of the game is to show that we need to be thinking carefully about the words that we're using so that we communicate God's truth. You know, the enormous amount of work that's been put into translating the Bible into many Indigenous languages in Australia has to keep going, because if God's word is true, then it needs to be communicated effectively. And for many Indigenous Australians in the Territory, communicating in English isn't optimally effective.
To what extent are barriers like literacy a real challenge in this area?
Yeah, there are challenges. There's a lot of Northern Territory languages that have at least the New Testament translated. There's only one complete Bible, that's in Creole, which is a language that developed out of Indigenous grammar, but mostly English vocabulary. So the whole Bible in Creole was published in about 2007. Many other languages have a complete New Testament, Barada, Al-Yawara, Jamarapoingu, Uboi, and then there are other languages that have bits of the Bible, Tiwi, Gunwingu, and Ziyakwa. There's a lot more still to do, but once the Bible has started to be translated, it means that there are groups of people in these languages who are thinking hard about what you might call theological language, and working out how to put key Christian concepts into their vernaculars.
We've spent a great deal of time discussing sharing what we understand of Christianity with Indigenous Australians. What are we learning? And through you, what can we learn from Indigenous Australia? Because it's not a top-down theology, it's a shared theology.
Yeah. So there's an old paradigm of Christian mission that thought about the West going to the rest.
Yeah.
But now people are seeing that really mission is about from everywhere to everywhere. And what I say to the Moore College students almost all the time, almost every day, is that we need to be reading the Bible with other people. Because in any culture, we're going to have blind spots. And the best way of overcoming them is through what you might call the other, through the person from a different cultural background or a different language. So some of the things that I think we benefit from hearing from Aboriginal people are things like corporate rather than individual focus, what it means to be one family. So as a Western Christian, you know, I've got the language of Christian family. I can call people my brother or sister. But in a way, that doesn't mean very much to me. But to hear what it means from an Indigenous Christian who comes from a social environment where everybody is called a kinship term, what does it mean for that person to be in this new family of God where everybody calls God Father, where everybody calls Jesus brother, regardless of who I call my aunties and uncles or brothers-in-law or boys and cousins, that kind of thing. Thinking also about our Western materialism, I think there's a message for us that we benefit from hearing from Indigenous Christians where much less value is placed on material objects, that relationships and right conduct towards people are so much more important.
As the soon-to-be sixth bishop of the Northern Territory, what is it that you're really looking forward to sinking your teeth into when you take up the role?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that the story about Jesus is what God uses to bring hope and restoration and transformation. And so I guess because my particular patch in the territory will be Anglican Christians and Anglican churches, it's really important for all kinds of Christians, but let's say including Anglicans, to have fresh and renewed confidence all the time in the message of Jesus as God's means of bringing hope and restoration and transformation. So anything that I can do to help the congregations that already exist to engage with their communities, their neighbourhoods, their work colleagues, their sport teams, their families, their kinship structures with that news of Jesus, that's really the very first thing. I'd love Anglican churches to grow. I'd love all churches in the territory to grow. And I think that will happen as people have confidence in the word about Jesus.
How would you encourage other Christians listening right now to actually really connect with an expression of Aboriginal faith and culture and Christianity?
That's a very good question. And the first thing that I want to say is that simply because of the numbers, not all non-Indigenous Australians are going to be able to have, you know, a deep and meaningful interface with Indigenous Australians. There are too many non-Indigenous Australians for all of them to be able to have a meaningful relationship with Indigenous Australians.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have to listen to what Indigenous Australians are asking for rather than us determining the agenda. And that's really hard for people like us who are used to being in control to do. I'll tell you what happens when you're approaching a group of Aboriginal people in Arnhem Land. The polite thing to do is, supposing you've got a little group of men talking, I'm a man, there's some business that I want to do with them or a conversation that I want to have with them. So I would just come up to about 5 or 10 metres away and just kind of stand there and, you know, maybe clear my throat, maybe not even do that, just stand there and then wait to see if they call me over. So what I wouldn't do, if I wanted to be polite, was just to bowl up to them.
Yeah.
And start talking. And I think that's a really useful little model. I just show that I'm there, ready to engage if you want to engage me, rather than just bowling in and saying, okay, here I am, you know, what do you want me to do?
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.